The primary. The sun has made a long, skidding crash landing along the Malay Peninsula a few hundred kilometers west, breaking open and spilling its thermonuclear fuel over about half of the horizon, trailing out a wall of salmon and magenta clouds that have blown a gash all the way through the shell of the atmosphere and erupted into space. The mountain containing the crypt is just a charcoal shard against that backdrop. Randy is annoyed with the sunset for making it difficult to see the construction site. By now, the scar in the cloud forest is mostly healed over, or at least some kind of green stuff has taken over the bare, lipstick-colored mud. A few Goto engineering containers still glower in the color-distorting light of the mercury vapor lamps around the entrance, but most of them have either moved inside the crypt or gone back to Nippon. Randy can make out the headlights of one house-sized Goto truck winding down the road, probably filled with debris for another one of the Sultan's land reclamation projects. Sealed up in the plane's nose, Randy can actually look forward out his window and see that they are landing on the new runway, built partly on such fill. The buildings of downtown are streaks of blue-green light on either side of the plane, tiny black human figures frozen in them. A man with a phone clamped between his ear and his shoulder. A woman in a skirt hugging a pile of books to her chest, but thinking about something far away. The view turns empty and indigo as the plane's nose tilts up for the landing. And then Randy's looking out over the Sulu Sea at dusk, where the Badhao's kite-sailed boats are scuttling into port from a day's fishing, hung all about with gutted stingrays, flying fresh shark's tails like flags. Not long ago, it was ridiculously exotic to him, but now he feels more at home here than he did in California. For Sultan-class passengers, everything happens with cinematic, quick-cut speed. The plane lands, a beautiful woman hands you your jacket, and you get off. The planes used by Asian airlines must have special chutes in the tail where flight attendants are ejected into the stratosphere on their 28th birthdays. Usually, there's someone waiting for a Sultan-class passenger. This evening, it's John Cantrell, still ponytailed but now clean-shaven. Eventually, the heat has its way with everyone. He's even taken to shaving the back of his neck, a good trick for shedding a couple of extra BTUs. Cantrell greets Randy with an awkward simultaneous handshake and one-armed hug body check maneuver.
"Good to see you, John," Randy says.
"You too, Randy,"
John says, and each man averts his eyes shyly.
"Who's where?" "Well, you and I are here in the airport. Abby checked into a hotel in downtown San Francisco for the duration."
"Good. I didn't think he was safe in that house by himself." Cantrell looks provoked.
"Any particular reason? Have there been threats?"
"None that I know of. But it's hard to ignore the high number of vaguely terrifying people wrapped up in this."
"No victim, Abby. Beryl's flying back to SF from Amsterdam. Actually, she's probably there by now."
"I heard she was in Europe. Why?"
"Strange government shiz going on there. I'll tell you later."
"Where's Eb?"
"Eb has been holed up in the crypt for a week with his team, doing this kind of incredible D-Day-like push to finalize the biometric identification system. We won't bother him. Tom's been drifting back and forth between his house and the crypt, run various kinds of torture tests on the internal crypt network systems, probing the inner trust boundaries. That's where we're going now."
"To the inner trust boundaries?"
"No. Sorry, his house."
Cantrell shakes his head.
It's not the house I would build.
I want to see it.
His paranoia is getting just a little out of hand."
"Hey, speaking of that..." Randy stops. He was about to tell Cantrell about Pontifex, but they are very close to the Halal Dunkin' Donuts, and people are looking at them. There's no way of telling who might be listening. "I'll tell you later." Cantrell looks momentarily baffled and then grins wickedly.
"Good one."
"We have a car?"
"I borrowed Tom's car, his Humvee. Not one of those cushy civilian models, a real military one."
"Oh, that's great," Randy says. "Does it come complete with a big machine gun on the back?"
"He looked into it. He could certainly get a license to own one in Kinakuta, but his wife drew the line at having an actual heavy machine gun in their domicile.
How about you? Where do you stand on this gun stuff?
I own them, and know how to use them, as you are aware,
Cantrell says. They are winding their way down a gauntlet of duty-free shops, really more of a duty-free shopping mall. Randy cannot figure out who actually buys all of these large bottles of liquor and expensive belts. What kind of blandly orgiastic lifestyle demands this particular selection of goods? In the time that's thus passed, Cantrell has evidently decided that a more thorough answer to Randy's gun question is merited.
But the more I practiced with them, the more scared I got. Or maybe depressed.
What do you mean? This is Randy in unaccustomed sounding board mode, psychotherapeutically prompting Cantrell for his feelings. It must have been a weird day for John Cantrell, and no doubt there are some feelings that need to be addressed.
Holding one of those things in your hands, cleaning the barrel and shoving the rounds into clips, really brings you face to face with what a desperate last-ditch measure they really are. I mean, if it gets to the point where we are shooting at people and vice versa, then we have completely screwed up. So in the end, they only strengthened my interest in making sure we could do without them.
And hence the crypt? Randy asks.
My involvement in the crypt is arguably a direct result of a very few bad dreams that I had about guns.
It is wonderfully healthy to be talking like this, but it is a portentous departure from their usual hardcore technical mode. They are wondering about whether it is even worth it for them to be mixed up in this stuff. Heedless certainty sure is easier.
Well, what about those secret admirers who are hanging around outside Ordo? Randy asks.
What about them? You're asking me about their state of mind?
Yeah, that is what we are talking about. States of mind. Cantrell shrugs.
I don't know specifically who they were. I'd guess there are one or two honest-to-God scary fanatics. Setting them aside, maybe a third of them are just too young and immature to understand what's going on. It was just a lark for them. The other two-thirds probably had very sweaty palms.
They looked like they were trying awfully hard to keep up a cheerful front.
They were probably happy to get out of there and to go sit in a dark, cool room and drink beer afterwards. Certainly a lot of them have been sending me email about the crypt since then.
As an alternative to violent resistance to the United States government, I assume, and
hope you mean. Exactly. Sure, I mean, that's what the crypt is becoming, right?
The question sounds a little querulous to Randy.
Right, he says.
He wonders why he feels so much more settled about this stuff than John Cantrell does, and then recalls that he has nothing left to lose. Randy takes one last breath of dry, machine-cooled air and holds it refreshingly in his lungs as they step out into the heat of the evening. He has learned to relax into the climate. You can't fight it. There is a humming logjam of black Mercedes-Benzes waiting to pick up the Sultan and Vizier-class passengers. Very few Walla-class passengers get off at Kinakuta. Most of them are in transit to India. Because this is the kind of place where everything works just perfectly, Randy and John are in the Humvee about 20 seconds later and 20 seconds after that, driving at 120 kilometers per hour down a long horizontal shaft of ghastly blue-green freeway light.
We have been assuming that this Humvee is not bugged, Cantrell says. So if you were holding back on something, you can speak freely now.
Randy writes, "Let's stop assuming anything of the kind," on a notepad, and holds it up. Cantrell raises his eyebrows one notch, but of course does not seem especially surprised. He spends all of his time around people trying to outdo each other in paranoia. Randy writes, "We have been under surveillance by a former NSA hondo gone private." Then he adds, "Probably working for one or more crypt clients." "How do you know?" Cantrell mouths. Randy sighs, then writes, "I was contacted by a wizard." Then, as long as John's preoccupied with working his way around a left-lane fender bender, he adds, "Think of it as due diligence, underworld style."
Cantrell says out loud,
Tom has been pretty scrupulous about making sure his house is bug-free. I mean, he built the thing, or had it built, from the ground up.
He veers off onto an exit ramp and plunges into the jungle.
Good. We can talk there, Randy says. Then writes,
Remember the new U.S. embassy in Moscow? Bugs mixed into the concrete by KGB. Had to be torn down. Cantrell grabs the pad and scribbles blind on the dashboard while maneuvering the Humvee up a curving mountain road into the cloud forest. What do you want to talk about that is so secret? Arethusa? Give me agenda, please. Randy. 1. Lawsuit and whether Epiphyte can continue to exist. 2. That NSA Tapper and Wizard exist. 3. Maybe Arethusa. Cantrell grins and writes, I have good news. Tombstones/. Forward slash in this context is Unix for the root of the file system, which in the case of Tombstone is synonymous with the hard drive that Randy tried to wipe. Randy raises his eyebrows skeptically and Cantrell grins, nods, and draws his thumb across his throat. Shea Howard is a flat-roofed concrete structure that, from certain angles, looks like a very large drainage culvert set vertically in a mound of grout on the top of a foothill. It becomes visible from one of those angles about 10 minutes before they actually arrive, because the road must make several switchbacks across the broad slope of that foothill, which has been involuted and fractalized by relentless drainage. Even when it's not raining here, the mere condensation of moisture from the South Sea breezes gathers on leaves and rains from their drip tips all the time. Between the rain and the plant life, erosion must be a violent and ravenous force here, which makes Randy a little uneasy about all of these mountains, because mountains could only exist in such an environment if the underlying tectonic forces were thrusting rock into the air at a rate that would make your ears pop standing still. But then again, having just lost a house to a Templar, he is naturally inclined to a conservative view. Cantrell is now drawing an elaborate diagram, and has even slowed down almost to a stop, the better to draw it. It begins with a tall rectangle. Set within that is a parallelogram, the same size but skewed a little bit downwards, and with a little circle drawn in the middle of one edge. Randy realizes he's looking at a perspective view of a doorframe with its door hanging slightly ajar, the little circle being its knob. Steel frame, Cantrell writes, hollow metal channels. Quick meandering scribbles suggest the matrix of wall surrounding it and the floor underneath. Where the uprights of the doorframe are planted in the floor, Cantrell draws small, carefully foreshortened circles, holes in the floor. Then he encircles the doorframe in a continuous hoop, beginning at one of those circles and climbing up one side of the doorframe, across the top, down the other side, through the other hole in the floor, and then horizontally beneath the door, then up through the first hole again, completing the loop. He draws one or two careful iterations of this, and then numerous sloppy ones until the whole thing is surrounded in a vague, elongated tornado. Many turns of fine wire. Finally, he draws two leads away from this huge door-sized coil and connects them to a sandwich of alternating long and short horizontal lines, which Randy recognizes as the symbol for a battery. The diagram is completed with a huge arrow drawn vigorously through the center of the doorway, like an airborne battering ram, labeled B, which means a magnetic field. Ordo computer room door.
Wow!
Randy says. Cantrell has drawn a classic elementary school electromagnet, the kind of thing young Randy made by winding a wire around a nail and hooking it up to a lantern battery. Except that this one is wound around the outside of a door frame and, Randy guesses, hidden inside the walls and beneath the floor so that no one would know it was there unless they tore the building apart. Magnetic fields are the styli of the modern world. They are what writes bits onto disks or wipes them away. The read-write heads of Tombstone's hard drive are exactly the same thing, but a lot smaller. If they are fine-pointed draftsman's pens, than what Cantrell's drawn here is a fire hose spraying India ink. It probably would have no effect on a disk drive that was a few meters away from it, but anything that was actually carried through that doorway would be wiped clean. Between the pulse gun fired into the building from outside, destroying every chip within range, and this doorframe hack, losing every bit on every disk, the Ordo raid must have been purely a scrap-hauling run for whoever organized it. Andrew Loeb, or, according to the secret admirers, Attorney General Comstock's sinister Fed forces who were using Andy as a cat's paw. The only thing that would have made it through that doorway intact would have been information stored on CD-ROM or other non-magnetic media, and Tombstone had none of that. Finally, they have made it up to the top of the hill, which Tom Howard has shaved to the bedrock in a kind of monk's tonsure. Not because he hates living things, though he probably has no particular affection for them, but to hold at bay the forces of erosion and to create a defensive glacis across which the movements of incredibly poisonous snakes, squirrel-sized insects, opportunistic lower primates, and villainous upper primates will be visible on the array of video cameras he has built into fairly subtle recesses and crevices up on the walls. Seen up close, the house is surprisingly not as dour and fortress-like as it looked at first. It is not just a single large culvert, but a bundle of them in different diameters and lengths, like a faggot of bamboo. There is a decent number of windows, particularly on the north side where there's a view, down the slope that John and Randy have just climbed, to a crescent-shaped beach. The windows are set deeply into the walls, partly to back them out of the nearly vertical rays of the sun, and partly because each one has a retractable steel shutter hidden in the wall that can be dropped down in front of it. It is an okay house, and Randy wonders if Tom Howard would be willing to deed it over to the dentist and hawk his colossal suite of Gomer Ball-strewed furniture and move his family into a crowded apartment building, just in order to retain control of Epiphyte Corporation. But maybe that won't even be necessary. John and Randy climb out of the Humvee to the sound of gunfire. Artificial light radiates upwards from a slot neatly dissected out of the jungle nearby. Humidity and clouds of insects make light a nearly solid and palpable thing here. John Cantrell leads Randy across the perfectly sterile parking slab and into a screened and fenced tunnel that has been stabbed into the black vegetation. Underfoot is some kind of black plastic grid that keeps the nude soil from becoming a glue trap. They walk down the tunnel until 20 or 30 paces later it opens up into an extremely long, narrow clearing, the source of the light. At the far end of it, the ground rises abruptly in a sort of berm, partly natural, Randy thinks, and partly enhanced with fill dirt excavated from the house's foundation. Two large paper targets in the shape of human silhouettes are clipped to a rack there. At the near end, two men with ear protectors pulled down around their necks are examining a gun. One of these men is Tom Howard. Randy is struck, but not really astonished, by the fact that the other one is Douglas MacArthur Shafto, evidently fresh in from Manila. The gun looks like exactly the same model that some of the black-hatted and bandana-masked posse were carrying yesterday in Los Altos, a long pipe with a sickle-shaped clip curving away from one side. Doug is in the middle of saying something and is not the type to interrupt his train of thought and fall all over himself being friendly just because Randy has recently traversed the Pacific Ocean.
"I never knew my father," he says. "My Filipino uncles used to tell me stories that he had told. When he was on Guadalcanal, the Marines, were still using their Springfields, the Ah-3 model, so 4 decades old, when finally the M1 rifle began to show up. So they took one of each rifle and tossed it into the water and rolled it around in the sand for a while and did God knows what else to it, but nothing that would be unusual in a real combat situation for a Marine. And then tried to operate them and found that the Ah-3 still worked and the M1 didn't. So they stuck to their Springfields. And I would say that some testing along those lines would be in order if you think you're really designing an insurgency weapon, as you say. Good evening, Randy."
"Doug, how are you?"
"I'm just fine, thank you."
Doug is one of these guys who always interprets how are you as a literal request for information, not just an empty formality, and always seemed slightly touched that someone would care enough to ask.
Mr. Howard here says that when you were sitting on top of that car typing, you were actually doing something clever and dangerous, at least from a legal point of view.
Were you monitoring that? Randy asks Tom.
I saw packets moving through the crypt and later saw you on television. I put two and two together,
Tom says.
Nice job, Randy.
He lumbers forward and shakes Randy's hand. This is an almost embarrassing outpouring of emotion by Tom Howard standards.
What I did there probably failed, Randy says. If Tombstone's disc was blanked, it was blanked by the doorframe coil and not by what I did.
Well, you deserve recognition anyway, which is what your friend is trying to give you,
Doug says, mildly irked at Randy's obtuseness.
I should offer you a drink and a chance to relax and all of that,
Tom says, looking towards his house.
But on the other hand, Doug says you were flying salting glass.
Let's talk out here, Randy says. But actually, there is one thing you could get me.
What's that?
Tom asks. Randy pulls the little disembodied hard drive out of his pocket and holds it up in the light, the wire ribbon a-dangle. A laptop computer and a screwdriver?
Done,
Tom says, and disappears down the tunnel. Doug, meanwhile, begins dismantling the weapon, as if just to keep his hands busy. He takes the parts out one by one and regards them curiously.
What do you think of the heap gun?
Cantrell asks.
I don't think it's as crazy as when I first heard of it,
Doug says.
But if your friend Avi thinks that people are going to be able to manufacture rifled gun barrels in their basements to protect themselves against ethnic cleansing, he's got another think coming.
Rifled barrels are hard, Cantrell says.
There's no way around it. They'd have to be stockpiled and smuggled. But the idea is that anyone who downloaded the heap and who had access to some basic machine tools could build the rest of the weapon.
I need to sit down with you sometime and explain everything else that's wrong with the idea,
Doug says. Randy changes the subject. How's Amy? Doug looks up and eyes Randy carefully.
You want my opinion? I think she is lonely and in need of reliable support and companionship.
Now that Doug has totally alienated both Randy and John, the gun range is completely silent for a while, which is probably how Doug likes it. Tom comes out with a laptop in one hand and, in the other, half a dozen blue plastic water bottles all shrink-wrapped together, already dribbling a trail of condensation.
I have an agenda,
Cantrell says, holding up the notepad.
Whoa! You guys are organized,
Tom says.
Item the first. Lawsuit and whether Epify can continue to exist.
Randy lays the laptop out on the same table where Doug is working with the heap gun and begins to remove screws.
I assume you guys know of the lawsuit and have worked out the implications of it yourself, he says.
If the dentist can prove that Doug discovered the wreck as a byproduct of work he did for us, and if the value of that wreck is high enough compared to the value of the company, then the dentist owns us, and for all practical purposes owns the crypt.
Whoa, wait a minute. The Sultan owns the crypt, Tom says. If the dentist controls Epiphyte, all he gets out of it is a contract to provide certain technical services in the crypt.
Randy senses everyone's looking at him. He twirls screws out of the computer, refusing to agree with this.
Unless there's something here I'm not getting, Tom says.
I guess I'm just being paranoid and sort of assuming that the dentist is somehow collaborating with forces in the U.S. government that are anti-privacy and anti-crypto, Randy says.
Attorney General Comstock's cabal, in other words,
Tom says.
Yeah, for which I have never actually seen any evidence at all, but in the wake of the Ordo raid, everyone seems to be assuming it. If that is the case, and the dentist ends up providing technical services to the crypt, then the crypt is compromised. We have to assume in that case that Comstock has a man on the inside.
Not just Comstock,
Cantrell says.
Okay, the U.S. government.
Not just the U.S. government,
Cantrell says.
The Black Chamber. What the hell do you mean by that?
Doug asks.
There was a high-level conference a couple of weeks ago in Brussels, hastily organized, we think, chaired by Attorney General Comstock, representatives of all the G7 countries and a few others. We know people from the NSA were there, people from Internal Revenue, Treasury people, Secret Service, their counterparts in the other countries, and a lot of mathematicians known to have been co-opted by the government. The U.S. Vice President was there. Basically, we think that they are planning to form some kind of international body to clamp down on crypto and particularly on digital money.
The International Data Transfer Regulatory Organization, Tom Howard says.
The Black Chamber is a nickname for that?
Doug asks.
That's what people on the Secret Admirers mailing list have started calling it,
Cantrell says. Why form this organization now? Randy wonders.
Because the crypt is about to go hot and they know it,
Cantrell says.
They are scared shitless about their ability to collect taxes when everyone is using systems like the crypt,
Tom explains to Doug.
This has been the talk of the Secret Admirers mailing list for the last week, and so when Ordo was raided, it really hit a raw nerve.
Okay, Randy says. I've been wondering why people showed up there almost immediately with guns and Stranger Things. He has got the laptop opened up now and disconnected its hard drive.
You have wandered off the agenda,
Doug says, pulling an oily rag down the barrel of the heap gun.
The question is, does the dentist have you guys by the balls or only by the short hairs? And that question basically revolves around yours truly, right?
Right, Randy says, a little too forcefully. He's feeling desperate for a change in subject. The whole Kepler epiphyte Semper Marine thing is stressful enough all by itself, and the last thing he needs is to be hanging around with people who believe it is nothing more than a skirmish in a war to decide the fate of the free world. A preliminary round of the apocalypse. Avi's obsession with the Holocaust seemed fine to Randy as long as Holocausts were things that happened long ago or far away. Being personally involved in one is something Randy can do without. He should have stayed in Seattle. But he didn't, and so the next best thing for him is to limit the conversation to straightforward things like bars of gold.
In order for him to have a claim, the dentist needs to prove that Semper Marine found that wreck when it was doing the cable survey, right?
Doug asks.
Right,
Cantrell says, before Randy can step in and say that it's a bit more complicated than that.
Well, I have been kicking around this part of the world for half of my life, and I can always testify that I found the wreck on an earlier survey. That son of a bitch can never prove that I'm lying,
Doug says. Andrew Loeb, his lawyer, is smart enough to know that. He will not put you on the stand, Randy says, screwing his own hard drive into place.
Fine. Then all he's got is circumstantial evidence. Namely, the proximity of the wreck to the cable survey corridor.
Right, which implies a correlation,
Cantrell says.
Well, it's not that damn close,
Doug says.
I was cutting a very wide swath at the time.
I have bad news, Randy says. First of all, it is a civil case, and so circumstantial evidence is all he needs to win. Secondly, I just heard from Avi on the plane that Andrew Loeb is filing a second suit for breach of contract.
What goddamn contract?
Doug demands. He has anticipated everything you just said, Randy says. He still doesn't know where the wreck is, but if it turns out to be miles and miles away from the survey corridor, he will claim that by surveying such a wide swath, you are basically risking the dentist's money in order to go prospecting. And that thus, the dentist still deserves a share of the proceeds.
Why does the dentist want to beef with me?
Doug says. Because then he can pressure you into testifying against Epiphyte. You get to keep all the gold. That gold becomes damages which the dentist leverages into control of Epiphyte.
Jesus fucking Christ,
Doug exclaims.
He can kiss my ass.
I know that, Randy says. But if he gets wind of that attitude, he'll just come up with another tactic and file another suit. Doug begins,
Well, that's kind of defeatist.
Where I'm headed with this, Randy says, is that we cannot fight the dentist on his turf, which is the courtroom, any more than the Viet Cong could have fought a pitched battle in the open against the U.S. Army.
so there are some really good reasons to get that gold out of the wreck surreptitiously before the dentist can prove it's there. Doug looks outraged.
Randy, have you ever tried to swim while holding a gold bar in one hand?
There's got to be a way to do it. Little submarines or something. Doug laughs out loud and, mercifully, decides not to debunk the concept of little submarines.
Supposing it was possible, what do I do with the gold then? If I deposit it in a bank account or spend it on something, what's to keep this Andrew Loeb guy from taking that as circumstantial evidence that the wreck had a ton of money in it? You're saying I have to sit on this money for the rest of my life in order to protect you from this lawsuit.
Doug, you can do this, Randy says. You get the gold. You put it on a boat. My friends here can explain the rest. Randy fits the laptop's plastic case back together and begins maneuvering the little screws back into their recesses. Cantrell says,
You bring the boat here.
Tom continues,
To that beach, right down the hill. I'll be waiting for you with the Humvee.
And you and Tom can drive it downtown and deposit that bullion in the vaults of the Central Bank of Kinnekuda,
Cantrell concludes. Someone has finally said something that actually knocked Doug Shafto off balance.
And get what in return?
He asks suspiciously.
Electronic cash from the crypt. Anonymous, untraceable, and untaxable.
Doug's regained his composure now and is back to belly laughs.
What'll that buy me? Pictures of naked girls on the World Wide Web?
Soon enough, he'll buy you anything that money can buy,
Tom says.
I would have to know a little more about it,
Doug says.
But once again, we are straying from the agenda. Let's leave it at this. You guys need me to strip that wreck bare, quickly and secretly.
It's not just what we need. It might be in your best interests, too, Randy says, groping on the back of the laptop for the power switch.
Item the second. A former NSA Hondo is surveilling us, and something about a wizard?
John says. Yeah. Doug's giving Randy a queer look, and so Randy launches into a brief summary of his classification system of wizards, elves, dwarves, and men, not to mention golems, which makes practically no sense to Doug, who hasn't read Lord of the Rings. Randy goes on to tell them about his conversation with Pontifex on the airplane phone. John Cantrell and Tom Howard are interested in this, as Randy would expect them to be, but what surprises him is how intently Doug Shafto listens.
Randy!
Doug almost shouts.
Didn't you at any point ask this guy why old man Comstock was so interested in the Arethusa messages?
Coincidentally, this is the third item on the agenda, Cantrell says.
Why didn't you ask him on the ski lift? Randy jokes.
I was giving him a very closely reasoned explanation of why I was about to sever the linkage between his ugly and perfumed corporeal self and his eternally condemned soul,
Doug says.
Seriously, you got the messages from your grandpa's old war souvenirs, right?
Right.
And your grandpa Waterhouse picked them up where?
Judging from the dates, he must have been in Manila.
Well, what do you imagine could have happened in Manila around that time that would be so damned important to Earl Comstock?
I told you. Comstock thought it was a communist code.
But that's bullshit,
Doug says.
Jesus, haven't you guys spent any time at all around people like Comstock? Can't you recognize bullshit? Don't you think it would be a useful item to add to your intellectual toolkits to be capable of saying when a ton of wet, steaming bullshit lands on your head, My goodness, this appears to be bullshit. Now, what do you think is the real reason Comstock wanted to crack Arethusa?
I have no idea, Randy says.
The reason is gold,
Doug says. Randy snorts. Oh, you've got gold on the brain.
Did I or did I not take you out into the jungle and show you something?
Doug demands.
You did, sorry.
Gold is the only thing that could account for it, because otherwise the Philippines just were not that important during the 50s to justify such an effort at the NSA.
There was an ongoing hook insurrection, Tom says. But you're right. The real focus, around here anyway, was Vietnam.
You know something?
Fires back Doug.
During the Vietnam War, which was old man Comstock's brainchild, The American military presence in the Philippines was huge. That son of a bitch had soldiers and Marines crawling over Luzon, supposedly on training missions. But I think they were looking for something. I think they were looking for the primary.
As in primary gold repository?
You got it.
Is that what Marcos eventually found?
Opinions differ, Duck says. A lot of people think that the primary is still waiting to be discovered.
Well, there isn't any information about the primary or anything else in these messages, Randy says. The laptop has booted up now in Unix mode with a torrent of error messages triggered by his inability to find various pieces of hardware that were present on Randy's laptop, which is in a Ford dealership's dumpster in Los Altos, but are not on Tom's. And yet, the basic kernel works to the point that Randy can look in the file system and make sure it's intact. The Arethusa directory is still there with its long list of short files, each file the result of running a different stack of cards through Chester's card reader. Randy opens up the first one and finds several lines of random capital letters.
How do you know there's no information about the primary in those messages, Randy?
Doug asks. Well, the NSA couldn't decrypt these messages in 10 years, Randy says. It all turned out to be a hoax, the output of a random number generator. Randy jumps back out to the file listing and types grep, uppercase AADAA, asterisk, and hits the return key. It is a command to find the opening letter group in the ETC card messages, the famous one to which Pontifex had alluded. The machine answers back almost immediately with an empty prompt, meaning that the search failed.
Holy shit,
Randy says. What? Everyone says at once. Randy takes a long, deep breath.
These are not the same messages that Earl Comstock spent 10 years attempting to break.